Welcome everyone to the Alt-Left Interviews. Here with me today is Matt, and we are actually interviewing a fantastic person here whose name is Phil Luce, ran for Simi Valley City Council District 1 in this last election. So thank you for being here with us today, Phil.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for those of you that don't know, because we do have several listeners that don't live anywhere in Southern California or even this country, Simi Valley is a small little town in Southern California. It's home of the Reagan Library. His presidential library is located here. It also has the distinction of being one of the more well-known red dots in the otherwise blue state. And one of the reasons Phil is notable is because he actually almost unseated the Republican incumbent for the district seat. Very close margins, by, we were just discussing, I believe, by about 100 votes. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it was like 142 votes in the end. It was came down to the wire, but not quite there.
Yeah. Which is unheard of in that area. Simi Valley is an incredibly red district. And so to actually be able to almost unseat a Republican in a district that is that deep crimson red is an impressive feat.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was. We knew going in it was going to be a challenge. It's so Simi Valley as a whole is probably around a plus four, plus five Republican city at this point. And just for those that may not be familiar with the terminology, when we say plus five, we mean registration. So there's about 5% more registered Republicans in the city than there are Democrats. But in District 1, it was actually about plus nine when we started. So it was even redder in my district than it was in the city as a whole. There are four districts in Simi Valley. The reddest is probably District 4, which is like the Bridle Path area down in the south part of Simi. But then right behind it is District 1, which is when I ran in. So we knew it was an uphill climb. We knew going against a Republican incumbent made it even harder. Incumbency is such a huge advantage, as you guys know. So, you know, yes, we're really proud of what we were able to accomplish. Wish we could have pulled it out, especially as I sit in on these city council meetings, you know, week after week. It's kind of tears at you, but no, we're really, really proud of the work that we put in and how close we did get.
Yeah, and I mean, it widened there a little bit, but the final counts for a long time had you within 12 votes of the incumbent, right?
Yeah, so the night of the election, the very first vote tally that came up, I was actually leading. And for those that maybe follow electoral politics, a lot of times Democrat votes come in late. We kind of saw that in Georgia with the recent election, right? So we see the Democrats kind of be behind at the beginning and then take over as the night continues. But because of this weird election here, and because of so many people were voting by mail, everybody voted by mail, or would go in person, drop off their ballot. With a few exceptions, there was in-person voting, but most people didn't do that. A lot of Democrats were really worried that the USPS was going to take a while. And so a ton voted super early rather than the trend that we saw, which is in the past, which was that Democrats vote late. So when the results first came through and I was leading, we were, you know, pretty confident that it was going to hold, especially if previous trends came to pass. But unfortunately, they didn't. It was a very different election. A lot of Republicans who weren't so keen on the mail-in ballots waited to do it in person the day of. And so that kind of boosted my opponent over the finish line at the end. So it was weird the night of the election to be getting tons of people congratulating me. Oh my gosh, I can't believe you did it. You pulled it off. And having to tell a lot of people, hold on a second, let's not count our chickens before they're hatched. And sure enough, it did go the other way, unfortunately. But yeah, at the beginning I was leading, and then the last official vote tally that night had me down by 12 votes. But as the votes started to come in, it became clear we weren't going to be able to close that gap.
So are you telling me that when an election doesn't turn out the way you want, it's not advisable to just simply declare it fraud?
Yeah, I advise against doing that. I think the recent days have shown that's probably not a great idea. Although how many of our senators are going to get away with helping to make that happen. I don't know. I hope not too many, but we'll see what happens there.
It is a strange day when a controversial political stance is believing in the fair democracy of elections.
It's very sad. And you know, it was funny. I had a couple people saying, well, you should fight it. You should do a recount. you know, the research says that recounts really don't ever make a difference unless it's within 0.05%.
Yeah.
I was down by like a full percentage point. So there was just no way a recount was going to do anything. And, you know, in my case, I would have had to pay for the recount to happen. And I had just spent basically all my money up until the end. So there was just not, you know, that wasn't going to happen. And it wouldn't have made a difference anyway. But, you know, we conceded because democracy matters, and handing over, conceding gracefully, I think matters. And that we were proud of, you know, our response through this is, I think matters for your reputation, and it's a reflection on the party as a whole. So we wanted to make sure we were representing the Democratic Party gracefully.
Well said. Absolutely. And yeah, I completely agree that individual actions on representing the changeover of power, you know, that legacy and that precedent that you set matters more than any single election. And the fact that win or lose on that election, everyone now, there can never be a time where anyone can doubt that you as a candidate will not cede to a proper and fair election.
Right.
Yep. It can't be called into question.
Exactly. And, you know, beyond myself and my own race, I think it's just incredibly important, especially now with what we've seen from our president and from some other candidates lower down on the ballot who have kind of followed the president's lead. It's more important now than ever to concede graciously, gracefully, and to ensure the public that things were fair and free, because it's a bedrock of who we are.
100%. Couldn't agree more.
Absolutely. Now let's talk a little bit about some of the platforms you had. Again, in this incredibly red conservative area, you know, I did 30 seconds of research on you, and in what I found, it makes sense in this area, you know, someone who's like involved in their church, someone who helps with the homeless and food distribution. But the ones that stood out were, A, you're apparently loved by unions.
Yeah,
you're obviously a pro-union candidate. Yeah. Your endorsement for unions are a mile long.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you actually have a stance, which I love, whether or not I actually, for instance, I'm a commercial driver. I actually don't do any drugs of any kind.
Yeah.
But you endorse legalization of marijuana, which I also agree with.
Yeah.
To eliminate a black market. What's your thoughts on that one for that area?
You know, the opinions on this, if you kind of follow the research a little bit in this area, have been shifting. I think the Overton window is shifting a little bit on this. So the more you talk about free and, you know, taking the restrictions off of marijuana and what it brings from a financial perspective, and the fact that, hey, we have a liquor store on like a bunch of corners here. What difference does it make to have legalized weed? Like, it really, what is the difference, honestly? The more you can kind of put that in people's brains, the more you can kind of push this as a normalized thing. And, you know, I think my position was, look, we need to be thoughtful about anything that's a major change to the city, but we have a huge gaping hole in Ventura County. If you're going to get weed, you go to Weed Maps or whatever, and you got to order it from the valley and it comes over. People are getting weed anyway. If you're going to smoke it, or you're going to, you know, chew a gummy with your friends, or you're going to do it regardless of whether you can get it in CME or whether you have to go to the valley, or you're going to have to get it from, you know, your buddy Frank's garage that he sells it out of. Wherever you're getting it, you're getting it.
Yeah.
So what's the point of pretending it doesn't exist and that people don't consume cannabis? Just deal with reality, acknowledge that it happens, and why not actually turn a profit for the city in making it legal and taxing it here? That's kind of my position. It just is a no-brainer to me. And we've seen research from cities all up and down California and in Colorado and Washington that have really turned around their city's finances with just this one change. And frankly, we badly, badly needed it. Even before COVID hit, our city finances were in major trouble. So to me, it just is you know, shooting yourself in the foot to not seriously consider opening things up for the sale of and taxation of cannabis here.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, my question I would pose is this. This always seems to be an opinion of the liberal side, the left side of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Which surprises me because we're talking about issues like personal liberty, body right. autonomy, elimination right. of criminal organizations and middlemen. Right. Like these are things, you know, and of course, taxation, entrepreneurship. These are right. things the Republican Party says they stand for.
Right.
Why do you think there's such opposition to it?
Well, I think there's a couple strains of within the Republican Party, right? You've got the libertarian strain that probably would be all on board with us on this. And mm-hmm. it's important to where you can find allegiances and alliances to use those. So, you know, I think they would probably be behind this. But there's also this longstanding, especially in the city of Reagan, right? Every drug is a bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Reagan had a legacy of being anti-drug in a completely harmful way that unfortunately has carried over through to today through many older people that live in the city still see it as a gateway drug, or they see it even in and of itself as a terrible thing. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of that to overcome. We are an older city with sometimes some older perceptions. And even among the Republican Party, it's, you know, things that were popular 20 years ago still hang on today, even if it's not as popular in the mainstream within the Republican Party. So I think we saw a little bit of that. But as I said, these opinions are changing. We see from the research in District 25, Congressional District 25, that this has shifted about 5 or 6 points in the last 4 years or so. So I think mm-hmm. we're there. It's just is, again, making it mainstream and not shying away from it rather than being ashamed of the position, be proud of it. So I tried to be proud of it and not shy away from it.
And you do a good job of it, too. I mean, it's one of the things that really drew me to you as a candidate. Unfortunately, and for those that don't know, I'm not going to say where, but I do happen to live in Simi Valley. That's how I'm familiar with Phil. He actually represented my district, but the district I was in before the election, and I actually moved just before mm-hmm. it happened. So I got was in a new district, but that's kind of how Phil became got on my radar. And kind of one of the things I wanted to ask you, Phil, is, I mean, our audience at this point, I think, is very well aware of where we stand politically.
Sure.
You know, just to recap, we've got Chris, who is our card-carrying communist. He's as left as you're going to get. Yep. We've got myself, who's basically your standard Bernie, AOC, progressive. Yep. And then our co-host who's not here today, Kay, he's our standard liberal Democrat. Mm-hmm. That's kind of our, you know, guidelines for this podcast. Where in there do you think you fit, personally and politically?
That's a great question. I've been thinking about this question a lot lately because, you know, there's this sort of conversation happening within the Democratic circles about labels, right? Are you a progressive or not a progressive? Are you a true progressive? Are you a bold progressive? What kind of progressive are you? And always come back to like, well, what is the policy? What policy are we talking about? Because I feel like we've sort of defined what a progressive is or what a liberal is by like 3 policies. Do you support Medicare for All, Green New Deal, you know, a couple of these big name policy positions? I think if I had to define myself, I would say I most closely align with social Democrats, is Sock Dem, as you might see it on Twitter. So that's probably where I most closely align. And that is very, very closely aligned with, you know, AOC, which is pretty much the far left of the party. It sounds like maybe Chris is even farther left to where even our farthest left politicians are in the party. And, you know, I have to say every year that I am alive, I move probably farther and farther to the left. So Chris, I'm probably not far behind joining you over there, but
journey. It's the same thing.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, with every passing year, it's frankly, it's just, I keep moving to the left. So I would say at this point, I would call myself a social.
Right on. And you know, that's kind of true. I remember right now, once again, I'm 36, I'll be 37 later this year.
Yep.
I was told all through high school, oh, just wait, the older you get, the more conservative you're going to get. And the opposite has held true. The older I get, the more left I go.
Yeah, no, this it's really true. I heard the same thing. You've probably heard the one, you know, if you're young and Republican, you don't have a heart. If you're old and Democrat or leftist, you don't have a brain, right? You've probably heard that before.
Yeah.
But let's keep in mind who came up with that quote. Winston Churchill, a man who willingly starved more people than Stalin.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 So Oh, isn't that always a fun conversation when people talk about how many people communism has killed? That's another conversation for another day. But I have found the opposite to be true as well. The more I read, the more I am around, you know, really smart people, a lot smarter than I am. The more I just realize how much I had ingrained into my brain that was almost propaganda for capitalism, for American imperialism, that you just kind of see normalized into our culture. And the more you sort of deprogram that, you sort of wake up and you have to, over time, deprogram a lot of these things that, frankly, are just so ingrained into who we are. It's hard to do without a deliberate effort to do so.
Yeah, it becomes a struggle.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it's funny how that the idea of simply looking at something, looking at a situation and going by simply what are the facts, what are the science, what is applicable, is considered a radical stance. You know, for instance, you call yourself a social democrat.
Yeah,
that's almost a negative buzzword in most political circles. And the Democratic Party is trying with all their might to scoot to the right and be more like, you know, Joe Biden and the Clintons, where most of the party is leaning towards the Ilhan Omar, Bernie Sanders, social democratic side. It's like the majority of the voters are actually going there and the party's like dragging their feet against what is reality.
You know, what's interesting. I actually posted something on Facebook the other day is I've actually been pleasantly surprised with the first 2 days of Joe Biden's presidency, some of his executive orders with the Keystone Pipeline and, you know, the amount of millions of people now are available for food stamps that weren't before, all types of things that I wasn't necessarily expecting from him. And I have to say, I think we may be pleasantly surprised by Biden, not because of who he is, but because of what you just mentioned, Chris, is just how much the current electorate within the Democratic Party is not going to allow them to move to the right, maybe as much as their natural inclination would want them to. I hope that's the case. I hope that people who have been awakened in the past 4 years or maybe have moved to the left, such as myself, continue to put his feet to the fire and local Democrats' feet to the fire to continue to push for policies that are popular with the people, which tend to be left of where a lot of the elected officials are. So I think we're going to, I hope, and this is my hope is that we'll start to see more power within local clubs, within, you know, state party. I think we're seeing it within the California Democratic Party moving to the left, or at least there's a movement to do so. I hope that all of those things combine together to push the party left. I am optimistic that it will happen. But of course, there are some strong forces that are pulling against that, and we'll have a lot of work to do.
100%. Yeah. Again, I perfectly said. Now, I actually have one policy question for you. Not that I'm trying to nail you. I actually don't even know where you stand on this.
Sure.
And the reason I bring it up is because no one's talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
In, you know, we've had COVID for a year, and there's been an incredible amount of talk of eviction moratoriums. And one of the things I've been impressed with Joe Biden about is that he's continuing that, and I'm glad for it.
Yes.
But to simply delay an eviction delays the inevitable. If someone has been out of work for 8 months, 6 months, even 3 months. I mean, let's face the facts. Most of the working class cannot go a month without a paycheck to pay their mortgage, pay their rent, feed their children. What do we as a society and as a politician, what kind of policies do we put in so that when this is lifted, when this COVID panic is over, we aren't just taking people who are already suffering and saying, well, the moratorium's over. You now owe $26,000 in rent. Pay immediately. Or you and your kids are home. What do we do about that gap of debt?
Well, you know, I if I remember correctly, there was also part of Joe Biden's executive orders. It had to do with some extended or expanded debt or rent relief as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to be enough. We know it's not going to be enough. It probably has to be expanded well beyond that. But this is certainly not my area of expertise. One thing that I think is always going to be a problem is that as long as land is privately owned, we're gonna have issues with rent and with income inequality forever and ever, and that's a contributing factor to all of this. But that's a sort of a philosophical question that goes beyond what we're discussing.
Well, you're earning my vote.
I, know you probably haven't had a chance to get too deep into our show yet, if at all, but like you're very much speaking mine and Chris's language right now.
Okay.
Kay is not quite there yet, but we're getting him. We're getting him slowly.
Well, have me on again and we'll get him on and we'll the three of us will convert him together. We'll work on it.
There we go.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, but as to your larger question, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that you're absolutely right that just, you know, turning on this, flipping on the switch when all of this is done and saying, all right, we're back to normal is impossible. And there will be a lot of hurting people who simply can't ever catch up and will be homeless. That's not acceptable. There's a combination of the city, local level, state level, and federal level that needs to be involved in this. But if I'm being totally honest, as somebody who was just running for local office, there's a lot at the federal level you just cannot do at a state level or a local level because you can't print money at a lot of local level. You know, that's the big part of what was so frustrating with the lack of federal response under Trump was, you know, the states are doing their best, but they have to have a balanced budget at the end of the year. Just like, you know, a city has to present a balanced budget. The federal government doesn't have to do that. They can print whatever money they want and pay for whatever they want. So it's a matter of, it's not because they can't, it's because they don't want to. And that's the most frustrating part is we could do it if we wanted to. We could pay for whatever we wanted to. And we just sort of choose not to, or we prioritize, you know, military spending that's just absurdly high over people. But
that, well, yeah, that's the issue, right? Is we always have money for war. We always have money to give tax breaks to the wealthy. But whenever the American people that are literally supporting this country need help, we don't have the money.
Suddenly the coffers are empty.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And you're already seeing this doublespeak from Republicans now, right? 2 weeks ago, nothing was being said about the debt or the deficit. And now 2 weeks later, they're already starting to pretend that they care and worry about it. They don't. Just the money dries up when people need it and Republicans don't want to pay it.
Yeah. And it was weird too, I shouldn't say weird, but it's so just on point because we had Bush, right? And the deficit, I believe, was over $1 trillion when he left.
Yeah.
Obama got it, regardless of how you feel about Obama, Obama got it down to about $500 billion. And now we're back up to $3 trillion. During the entire 4 years of Trump, never once did I hear a single Republican complain about the deficit. And now all of a sudden, 2 days into the administration, and here it comes. You can see it coming.
Yeah. Oh, it's already there. I mean, I've seen it all over Twitter with some of these these fake concerns, crocodile tears over the deficit. And it's honestly, it's a veiled threat against changing anything within the status quo. Maybe not so veiled, but it's really a shot across the bow to say, don't change anything. You know, we're not going to give you the money you need for people where we want things to stay the way that they are. And, you know, now it's incumbent upon Democrats to say, give them the middle finger and say, we control the Senate, the House, we can kill the filibuster, and they should do it because there's no reason to be held hostage by Republicans when you have a chance like we have right now to fix all types of things at the federal level.
100%. Couldn't agree more once again. The last thing I wanted to ask you before you wrap this up here, though, is kind of in that same vein. So one of the biggest issues we've always had, and again, anybody who's been a fan of our show for a while knows, the only people we go after harder than Republicans are Democrats. And the main reason we do that is because, you know, unfortunately, with leadership like Schumer and Pelosi, not to discount whatever good they have done, but there's a reason that people have that meme of Dems being spineless, Dems being weak. It's because whenever we have control, it's all of a sudden we want to go to the negotiating table. When Republicans have control, they don't give a crap. They're going to just say whatever they want, do whatever they want, take whatever they want.
Yep.
And that's the big thing that I'm worried about. Biggest problem we have right now is the Schumers and Pelosis who are just always willing to negotiate when they should be fighting.
Yeah.
What is your take on that situation? And do you think there's actually a chance with them still in the driver's seat?
I have to hope that there's a chance because otherwise I don't mean to sound like a doom and gloom guy, but if they don't take the opportunity now with the 2 years we have before the midterm elections to fix and push through literally every single thing that is at the top of the agenda to ensure that there isn't a minority Republican rule within this country for generations to come, to make sure that, you know, they kill the filibuster to push through, whether it's student debt relief or minimum wage, all these things that are incredibly important that would actually help them win elections in 2 years. If they don't do these things now, that's never going to happen. This is the only chance that I see us having. And, you know, you worry about the Joe Manchins and the ones that are you know, so reluctant to kill the filibuster, to change anything the way that it's been done for generations. That worries me too. But I have to hold out hope that maybe eventually they'll see that this Republican Party is not one that will ever be negotiated with. You can't do it. You simply cannot do it. You have to just ignore it, push them aside and say, we're going to do what we know is right for the American people. And if they don't do it now, they're going to lose in 2 years, and we will probably be up against it for generations to come and trying to win the power back. And that's why I think it's incredibly important for every single one of us to be involved, to put our local elected leaders' feet to the fire and continue to push for this, because there will never be a chance like we have right now.
Yeah, and I think that's a message that gets lost a lot. You know, and I'm the first one to often crap on and go after, you know, lifetime established Washington politicians. Sure. Of either party. But we can't ever not be involved, even if we don't like the Electoral College, even if we don't like a Sure. two-party system. Regardless of what your complaints are, I agree that no matter what, at the very least, at the minimum, you can at least minimize harm by voting, being active. And you can also, that's how democracy works, get active with candidates. Go yeah. small, go big, find people you like, find people who speak for what you believe in, and get involved, because that's really how things change.
It is. And I'll just tell you, as somebody who is running for office and who has been involved now and has relationships with some local politicians just respond to pressure. They do. It's I don't know how else to put it, but when there are enough people who are pissed off and vocal and in their ear about a specific thing, it's impossible to ignore. And so I don't, you know, going on Twitter and complaining about it there or on social media is one thing, but actually getting together with a group of people and saying, let's grow this movement, let's be in the ear of our local politician to say, this is what we want, demanding it day after day after day. That is honestly how politicians will eventually do what you want them to. There's no other way. Because the only other way they respond to is money. And unfortunately, money's a part of the politics. So we have to be louder than the money. And we need to have a lot of people making a lot of noise.
Ooh, agreed.
Yeah.
Phil, thank you so much for coming on here. I super appreciate the time you have. I hope we can have you on again sometime. I would love to have you as a friend of the show.
Yeah, it would be my pleasure. This was a lot of fun. And 30 minutes flew by. Hopefully we can do an hour next time. And just maybe we'll get some gummies from the valley and make it a
That would be fantastic. So yeah, again, thank you everyone. This is Phil Luce, District 1 of Simi Valley. He's not going away. He will return. Get in touch with this guy, look him up online. You can find him on Twitter at Phil D. Luce. You can find him on Facebook. He stands for a lot of really good things, and he's supported by all the right groups and actually gives a damn about the voters and his constituents. So find him, see what he's into, check him out. Phil, thank you so much again for coming and joining us. And I really hope we hear from you again, man.
I appreciate it. And I'll just give one more plug here. So my Phil D. Luce on Twitter was my political one. If you want to get onto my personal one and see what I really, really think on the left of where I was, even on the public page, it's I_am_puddle. So that's my Twitter handle. For my personal page, please follow me, interact with me. Let's become friends.
There you go, everybody. Even more breaking news from the Alt Left podcast.
There you go. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you again, Phil. Have a great one.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, man. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks again, everyone, for sticking around for that. That was our interview with Simi Valley politician Phil Luce. And again, please check him out online. He is on Twitter at I_M_puddle. Give him a shout. Give him some love. If you're interested in any kind of local politics, he's someone we absolutely endorse, friend of the show. And again, guy who's on the right side of history and the kind of leadership we need at a local level. So thanks for being here with us. We hope to hear from Phil again, and we'll see you all soon.